You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
So thank you, all of you, for joining our breakout session this afternoon. And sorry we started a little bit late. I know that the lunch ran over a bit. I want to first thank the Congressional Internet Caucus, the board of the Internet Caucus, for putting this panel together. I think it's extremely timely, and we have really just an outstanding panel here, so I'm extremely pleased. I will introduce myself, and then I will announce the panelists. I'm not going to go into biographies because I don't think that's a very good use of our time. We have just an unbelievably experienced panel here that I think, in my view and the view of so many people in Washington and nationally and internationally, recognize everybody on this panel for their leadership in broadband access, broadband financing, and deployment across this country. My name is Jessica Zuffolo. I am the Deputy Administrator for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Utility Service. And I've been in my position for about 3.5 years, a little bit over 3.5 years. And I am very honored and lucky to be part of our president's work on broadband. We were extremely pleased at RUS to be part of the historic work under the Recovery Act. We did about 320 broadband fiber-to-the-home and middle-mile projects in rural, unserved, and underserved portions of the United States for roughly $3.5 billion. We did about $100 million in satellite awards and 19 technical assistance grants. So thank you for being here with us today. So what I will do is announce who we have on our panel, which you all know, and then what I will do is then immediately turn to Kevin Lowe. We're going to go down the table here, and each of our panelists will give about, I would say, very general 3 to 5 minutes of overview on what their respective company and organization is doing to meet the nation's needs for high-capacity bandwidth in the most, both in urban and rural areas. Our government obviously has, I think, a strong, very, I think, high-profile and robust story to tell on the needs for communities across this country to get affordable, high-capacity broadband to ultimately revitalize the economic landscape, attract jobs, attract new at-risk businesses, and provide solutions to the communities, both on a last mile, both to the last mile as well as to anchor institutions. These are extremely important objectives for the Obama administration and for all of us. So first, on to my right, we have Kevin Lowe, who is the general manager for Google. Next to Kevin, we have Blair Levin, who is the Communications and Society Fellow for the Aspen Institute and the founder of the GigU initiative, which is extraordinary, and we're really pleased to have him join us. Next to Blair, we have Ramona Carlo, who is the Vice President of Public Policy and Strategy for AT&T Communications. And next to Ramona, we have James Assey, who is the Executive Vice President for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. And I would say that James and even Blair have been remarkable mentors and leaders to me and to many others who have been part of the work that we've been doing across RUS and NTIA. So thank you. And with that, I will turn it to Kevin to talk about what Google is doing.
Hi, my name is Kevin Lowe. I'm the GM of Google Fiber, Google Access, actually. But I run our fiber business, which I think some of you might have heard about. We're rolling out a gigabit internet service in Kansas City, and that's Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri. So I'm going to try to keep this relatively brief. I know there's plenty of time for Q&A. But I'd like to do really two things. One, let me give you a thumbnail sketch about what we're doing in Kansas City specifically. And then two, I want to take a step back and maybe give you a little context as to why Google's even doing this to begin with. And so Kansas City, why not Kansas City? It's in the center of the U.S. It looks like America. It's a great community. We announced that we were building and deploying our services there probably a little bit more than a year ago now. And this past summer, we went back and we officially launched our service. What is our service? It is gigabit to the home. That's 1,000 megabits up and down. So it's a symmetric gig into everybody's home. It costs $70 a month. For users that want, they can subscribe to a gigabit and TV offering. There are plenty of reasons that our TV offering is great. All the channels you want, really high-quality HD. For the tech geeks in the room, there's a really big difference between HD and really high-quality HD, and a set of user experiences that go along with that premium content. And that costs $120 a month. And then finally, for users, if you're not quite ready for a gig today, as we're building in your neighborhoods, you can pay a $300 construction fee where we construct a drop going from the side of the curb into your home, and then you can get today's broadband at 5 megabits per second down, 1 megabit a second up, free of any monthly recurring charge for at least the next 7 years. So those are the three offerings that we're taking into the marketplace. We started installing users in the tail end of the year, in Q4. I think we've told the press that we were doing our first customer install in November. But we've been installing pretty aggressively since October. And I think all of the processes that we're running have been public. We do a build-to-demand model. So we've asked Kansas Cityans to let us know who's interested in the service. And then we've been building out those fiberhoods, you know, sort of one, multiple fiberhoods at a time. The results have been outstanding. We've been really, really humbled by what we've seen. One, the products have been very well received by our users. But probably the most interesting thing that we've seen are the sort of the innovation, Silicon Prairie, all the startups that are flocking to the early fiberhoods that we've installed so far. So we're excited about what 2013 brings. Let me take a step back and talk a little bit about Google's overall initiatives here and why we care, why we're focused on this to begin with. We believe fundamentally that ubiquitous, high-speed, affordable broadband is a critical investment in America's future. If you look at the internet as a segment of GDP, it's around 4.7% if you were actually characterized that way. Businesses that use the web grow 40% faster than businesses that don't and are more than twice as likely to create jobs. So the internet is clearly the engine for growth. And at Google, we believe that speed matters. Not so much the incremental changes in speed, but really a step function in improvement. And that, again, is going from the average out there in the market, which is 5 megabits a second, 5.8, is what most Americans get at home. And taking that number up to 1,000, we think, is the type of step function that will drive innovation. We believe that gigabit connectivity at home is the foundation for this innovation. We've seen that energy unleashed in Kansas City, and we're very excited about that. And then finally, I'd probably like to close here by just outlining a couple things that we've learned along the way, working with the city governments and the utilities in both Kansas City, Kansas, and Missouri. There are a lot of things that communities can do to be more fiber-friendly and encourage new entrants to come in and deploy new sets of services. And for us, I'd probably outline five quick items that we would call out. One, have a vision of what gigabit can do for you. Number two, make a plan and staff people against it. You'll notice that in the city development agreements we put in place with both city governments, we really put a lot of emphasis on processes that could help us build more effectively. And when I talk about people, having a single point of contact, it sounds very obvious to a lot of folks in the business community, but that's something that was very important. So staff people against it. Third, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there. Even before a new provider comes into your area, if you're going to rip up a road, install conduit. Four, cut the red tape. There are benefits to having a single point of contact, but underneath that, there still is a way to streamline the process, and I could walk through the myriad of steps along the way. But I just close out with fifth, sharing your resources. In order for us to build in Kansas City, We need access to polls, real estate, rights of way, et cetera. And for those, we would encourage cities to take an inventory, decide what price points you need, and be ready to negotiate. And we'd also encourage the cities to be very thoughtful about the things that they want, because this is a great opportunity to work with new providers to make those capabilities come true. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll be happy to take questions later.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Blair?
Thank you, Jessica, and again, congratulations on the success of your investments in broadband in America. So I'm going to do a very quick history of kind of big bandwidth, at least as far as I know it in the last few years. As we were doing the broadband plan, one of the things we realized near the end was we had the benefit of looking out 5 to 10 years. There was some concern as we looked at the announced investments that investment in wireline was in a tricky place because cable not only had the better network but also the cheaper upgrade path. And if you understand Wall Street, you understand that makes it very difficult for telcos or anybody else to invest, which also means the cable guys don't have an incentive to upgrade. We did not accept the view that some urged on us that we should try to get a gigabit everywhere because it's a huge investment. We don't know what does wireless do and stuff. But we also, if you think of it kind of from a hedge strategy, we weren't comfortable with the notion that the United States would have a hedge, would have a gig nowhere. We weren't comfortable with the notion that the top 50 cities in the world, in terms of bandwidth, none of them would be in the U.S. They'd all be in Asia or Scandinavia. And so we started a discussion with various folks about what do we do about this. Out of those discussions, by the way, you know, Google kind of came in and said, we kind of agree that we need to do something and we'll do one, which we thought was phenomenal and I still do, and they deserve all the credit for that. But we articulated in the plan a need for a critical mass of communities to have not just good networks but the best networks in the world because you need an ecosystem of people who know how to design, build, operate, and most importantly, build applications on top of not just good connectivity but great connectivity as we move in this historic transformation from a world in which fundamentally economics is about the manipulation of atoms to the manipulation of bits, chips, and bandwidth. When 1,100 communities applied for the Google project, what was really interesting, and Kevin really just referred to this, all of us who have any minimal understanding of network deployment understand the roles that communities play. So the question was, you know, not just relying on Google and not just having one, how do we take that political capital that's been created by this effort to get 1,100 communities to organize and try to turn it into not just one community but a dozen or maybe two dozen or whatever. Thought about, by now I'm at the Aspen Institute, you know, which communities have high density, high demand, pre-existing networks, and are the most innovative communities. The answer came back, of course, university towns. Organized a bunch of university towns who were applying for Google Fiber and we thought probably weren't getting better. And that was the roots of Gig.U. And what Gig.U is really, we're not a principal on a deal, we're not a service provider, we're not an investor. What we are is a learning community. And the idea is to help each other figure these kinds of things out. Now, we, by the way, have stolen shamelessly from what Kevin learned in Kansas City. And we've created various tools for communities, worksheets for communities to both assess what assets matter, what regulatory processes matter, and things like that. We have demand tools. We basically have come up with a formula that involves how do you lower CapEx, OpEx, and risk, and how do you increase revenue, system benefits, and competition. Those are the six factors that matter. And by the way, those, if you look at every network upgrade this country has ever had, you will find a public policy that changed the equation by causing one of the first three, one or more of the first three to go down, and one of the last three, one or more of the last three to go up. So it's not just, you know, in this situation, it was pole attachments for the cable industry years ago. Every upgrade involves that. So what we do is we try to help our communities understand what needs to be done. We've had projects that we're working on that have already been announced in Gainesville, Florida, in Orono, Maine, in Cleveland. We announced all these projects are smaller than, by the way, what Kansas City is doing. And they are in some ways different, but each one gets a little bit bigger and learns from the other. In October, announced one in Chicago. In December, announced one in December. The next announcement will be in February of a group of communities. So with each one, there's a little more wisdom that gets shared. I might also note that one of the things that came out of the process, the RFI process that we ran, was that there were a lot of rural communities that, particularly rural college communities, that are really suffering for lack of bandwidth because they can't attract faculty, faculty can't do their work, they can't attract students. It's very problematic for them. The kind of fiber-based solution that we were looking at with, in Seattle, Washington, wouldn't really make sense in some of these, but we thought that there might be spectrum-based solutions, created a new group that we're now part of, but has a lot of other members, including Google, by the way, called Air.U. They'll be announcing their first pilot project, we hope, in February. These things you don't know until they happen, but that's the current plan. So the idea is helping communities take a little bit more control over their bandwidth destiny. And I would just emphasize that this is really about economic development, because every mayor that I've talked to, every university president that I've talked to, it's always about how do we make sure that in this era of big data and big bandwidth, we have the tools. And I would not say that every American needs a gig in their home today, but at least we have the tools to drive, whether it be genetic sequencing, the utilization of 8K, the utilization of certain kinds of robots, that we drive that ecosystem, which, frankly, we're well positioned. I think the president said this time, what did he say yesterday? We were meant for this time. He had a better phrase. He has a better speechwriter than I do.
We the people.
That part I remember, but this one. But anyway, I think America is very well positioned if we have the bandwidth in a strategic number of communities. So those two efforts are about.
Thank you so much, Blair. Ramona?
Good afternoon. I'm Ramona Carlo with AT&T, and it's a real honor to join my fellow panelists in this discussion today. I think certainly the one thing that we can all agree on is the fact that broadband is a significant force for economic growth, job creation, and for innovative services for consumers. And AT&T supports efforts to promote the deployment and adoption of robust, ubiquitous, broadband networks, including the National Broadband Plan and the goal for universal broadband. But in order to meet those objectives, clearly, it's going to take billions of dollars of private investment. And so I wanted to spend these first few minutes as I'm speaking with you to go over how AT&T is approaching this big broadband challenge. As many of you probably heard, in November, we announced a three-year, $14 billion capital investment plan. We call it Project Velocity IP. And it will significantly expand and enhance both our wireless and wireline IP broadband networks. And this breaks out to about an $8 billion wireless capital investment and $6 billion wireline investment, with total capital spending for AT&T expected to be approximately $22 billion for each of the next 3 years. So let me break this down just a little bit more. So nationally, we plan to expand our 4G LTE network to cover 300 million people throughout the United States by year-end 2014. So throughout the country, we'll be adding more facilities, macro sites, distributed antenna systems, small cells, all to improve the reach, capacity, and performance of our network. And those improvements will allow us to more efficiently use our spectrum. And in our 22-state wireline area, this means we're going to reach 99% of customer locations with expanded 4G LTE coverage to deliver voice and broadband services by the end of 2014. Through Project Velocity IP, we also plan to expand and enhance our wireline IP network to reach a total of 57 million customer locations, and that's both consumer and small business, by year-end 2015. So this means that we're going to be providing advanced wired broadband services to 75% of customer locations in our 22-state wireline service area. And that includes expanding UVerse, our integrated voice, data, and IPTV platform, by more than a third, or about 8.5 million additional customer locations, reaching a planned total of 33 million customer locations. And not only will we be providing broadband more broadly, but it's going to be faster with the enhancements that we'll be using. And Project Velocity IP also includes bringing fiber to an additional 1 million business customer locations by year-end 2015. So this is significant. Together, these network investments are expected to provide high-speed IP internet access via IP wireline and 4G LTE to 99% of customer locations in our wireline service area and 300 million people nationally. So we're going to be transforming our old telephone network into an IP-only platform for the future. Now, this substantial investment is a business imperative to meet the demands of our customers. And it's also the kind of infrastructure that policymakers and all of us have been talking about when we're urging, you know, these investments to push America even closer to the national policy goal of ubiquitous broadband. But more investment's going to be needed to keep up with customer demand, and it's really going to take all of our collective effort to facilitate and accelerate that IP transformation by all providers and for all Americans. And to that end, AT&T, as I'm sure you've heard, has been talking about how critical it is that regulation be modernized so that all companies can direct more investment toward the new IP services that customers are demanding and not directing investment to maintain the old network and services that fewer and fewer people want. The regulatory environment influences providers' investment decisions, and that matters more today than ever. So we've asked the FCC to take a leadership role in launching trials in a few select wire centers as a means for discussing and really testing what will be needed from a technology and a policy perspective to make sure that we do accelerate the transition to an all IP, all IP services nationwide. So with that, I'll stop for now and look forward to the rest of the discussion on this.
Thank you, Ramona.
Mm-hmm. So batting cleanup. Let me start off by saying when I kind of looked at the panel on the topic of big broadband, it, you know, brought to mind, you know, well, what do we mean by big? You can go a lot of different directions. You can go back to Tom Hanks and, the Zoltan or whoever that fortune teller was who told us the future. But before we look at the future, I think it's important, at least from the cable's perspective, to also look at the past because I think, you know, the developments we've seen in recent months, Google's launch as a distributor in Kansas City, obviously all of the energy and activity around GigU are certainly positive developments and have brought a lot of interesting questions to the discussion that we'll get into. But, you know, from the cable perspective, I think the pursuit of big broadband starts a long time ago when broadband was really, really tiny. We have to harken back to a time when 56 kilobits was the extent of our connection. And through a lot of moxie and intestinal fortitude, cable industry has invested over $200 billion to really revolutionize its plant in order to build what we believe are state-of-the-art networks that are only getting better. You know, if you look just back to 2009 with the current generation of DOCSIS technology, DOCSIS 3.0, at that time only 20% of U.S. households were passed by DOCSIS technology that are capable of providing 50, 100-plus megabit connections. Today, as we sit here, we're talking about 85% of households are now passed by those networks. That's a sea change, particularly when you're thinking about an HD video roughly requires, somebody here will tell me, but I think 5 or 6 megabits per second. It's not to say we won't want more. I think I agree with Blair that we certainly don't need a gigabit in every home today. Certainly, even if we got it, I think our Wi-Fi routers might have something to say about whether or not we'd actually get 1 gigabit in our home.
The Wi-Fi is going to
I mean, the next generation of Wi-Fi is going to solve that problem faster than we're going to solve it.
Well, I hope so. I guess I only raise it to say that there are a lot of different reasons that go into speed, whether it's your Wi-Fi router, whether it's how fast the server is providing you with the content. And that's not to say that, you know, these chicken and egg problems aren't something that we all should focus on. But I think what the breadth and the reach that cable has been able to provide in upgrading its networks really stands out as a significant accomplishment in recent history, and credit to the administration and an approach that's been based on a light regulatory touch to really create the incentives for continued capital investment. And I'd agree with Ramona, even though we have grown to such dizzying heights, there's still a lot of reach left in the hybrid fiber coax plant. We see almost daily stories where providers are increasing their speeds. Time Warner Cable just recently increased their standard transmission speed for internet by 50%. Comcast just announced that it's increasing its core network to handle 100 gigabit traffic. And the list goes on and on. It seems like every day that there's another announcement in the offing. Continued work goes on in future DOCSIS specifications as well. So I think the good news for all of us is that there is still a lot of room to run, whether it's in a fiber architecture, whether it's in a cable architecture. And at the end of the day, consumers will be the better for all of this competition, for all of this innovation that is taking place. I think one of the things that I think we find encouraging, and I guess I want to maybe at least make a distinction that is hopefully not antagonistic. When Blair speaks of the experimentation of trying to create kind of gigabit communities in various places, I think that's a positive discussion. And I think as we've seen with the Google Kansas City experiment as well, there are a lot of regulatory factors, a lot of obstacles, a lot of problems that we can perhaps shed a light on to see if there are ways that we can create incentives for private providers to put new investment in communities and to build faster capabilities so long as there is a business case to be made. What I do think is important that as we, pursue these types of policies, we do it in a way that will, promote a level playing field among the providers that are all trying to provide consumers with the same benefits, that of greater connectivity that they need to do the things that they want to do in their daily life. So I think that is kind of one of the challenges that we face as we continue to have this discussion. I think it's important that we focus on it, but I think it's also important that we continue to focus on the reach of broadband and that we think of big not only in terms of the speed, but also of ensuring that we increase the capabilities of all Americans. We've now gotten to the point in this country where 3 out of 4 households this year will have a home broadband connection, and that's pretty astounding. And in fact, if you go back and you track the adoption of broadband technology against other types of network technology, whether you're talking about electricity or the cell phone or the PC, you've adopted broadband at a much faster rate than any of those technologies, and there's certainly more room to run there. But I think as we think of increasingly about bigness and how we are going to revolutionize the inclusiveness of this technology that helps us educate ourselves, get jobs, we also have to think about how we can extend and create the value and relevance to that last 25%. And to the FCC's credit, I've done a lot of work focusing on this problem with Connect to Compete, and I know a number of our cable companies, including Time Warner and Charter and Comcast with its Internet Essential programs, are focused on that problem as well. So I'll stop there.
Thank you so much. So it's on the value of broadband as a great catalyst for economic development is clearly unquestioned, and it's something I think that the entire sector is in unison on And I think everyone here would agree with that. But the challenges that we're facing here in terms of the last mile economics continue to be a challenge. And so as we think of how, you know, how the sector can continuously focus on dedicating their resources to meeting not just middle mile challenges, but the last mile challenge. I know that that the Kansas City project is terrific in many ways. What I'd like to ask the panel, and all the work that's done across this panel represented here, but what I'd like to ask everybody here is, how do we grapple with the last mile economics, not just in suburban communities, but really in the most rural, unserved areas? How do we drive that investment further, knowing that the cost of service, the cost of deployment, and quite honestly, the cost of the average revenue per user and the ability of those customers to afford a gig, you know, is almost untenable. So how do we really drive broadband deeper into not just, you know, again, moving from the middle mile community anchor institution deployment into the fiber to the prem, you know, realm? How do we manage those economics knowing that the costs are just so high? So do you want to start, Kevin? We'd love to see all of you do more into these areas.
I was going to say, I'm really not the expert in when it comes to rural, and I would defer that to distinguished, you know, panelists here that could speak more intelligently about it. In Kansas City, it's an urban and suburban market. That's really what we've been focused on. And I would say, I would say this: technology innovation, the pace that we've seen has changed dramatically the set of economics that are available to service providers that are building infrastructure like us. Meaning the cost profiles are fundamentally different than they, you know, today. Number two, it's really about the users and making users care about gigabit connectivity to the home. I would say number one, Blair referenced the RFI that we had had out there, 1,100 communities representing almost half the population of the U.S. clearly had a vision for what they wanted in their communities and what fiber could do. And number two, the evidence on the ground from our user base has been outstanding in terms of individual users that want that level of speed. Not that they're going to fill the entire gig pipe, but the latency, the snappiness of the user experiences, and the types of applications. So from our standpoint, I think the user user adoption has always been the big issue out there, and can you create a product that users really want? So I'll leave it at that, and I'll honestly would defer the rural conversation to some of the other folks here.
Blair?
I'll make two observations. First, one of the big questions that any serious policymaker has to grapple with is, does wireless compete with wired? It's actually a very complicated question, and it's constantly changing as technology changes and markets change. I think as a practical matter, the rubber will meet the road. You could have said it met the road, actually, with the review of the Verizon Spectrum Co. deal, but order of magnitude in 2014, the LTE network will cause a disruption, shall we say, in the way we currently think about universal service. And point where the question will be raised, does wireless compete with wired? And I don't know what the answer will be. But one of the things I would say is actually wireless is going to do a very good job of delivering a lot higher levels of connectivity to rural America. Satellite has improved. But for certain kind of institutions like hospitals, it's not going to be enough, and then you're not sharing the network, and it's actually a very hard problem. So I don't really have an answer, but as though the FCC did some very good things with USF reform, I think we're going to have to come back to that problem sometime in the next few years as markets do certain things which actually are good on some levels but undercut the current economics in certain situations. The second thing I would say is that I just keep coming back to the same formula. It's not as elegant as E equals MC2, but C plus O is greater than risk-adjusted revenues plus system benefits plus the competitive threat. Keeps working, and I would just note a couple of things.
Blair's law.
Yes, well, it's not a law; it's just an equation. The cable industry deserves an awful lot of praise for driving broadband in America. They clearly did a great job, but I think that, you know, when you look at what actually happened, what you recognize is They didn't just suddenly say, we need to do internet because it's cool. What happened was Congress passed the program access rules, which, by the way, follow that equation in creating opportunities for the DBS industry. Cable said, oh, my God, there's a competitor that has a better picture and a better transmission vehicle. We need to be able to do something they can't. They started to invest heavily, you know, and they deserve all the credit for this. They started to invest in broadband, which then caused the phone companies to say, oh, my God, we can't just do dial-up. We have to bring out this DSL thing, which caused the cable guys to upgrade their cable modems, and which is great. I'm just saying that those policies that led to that, they were all great, but that seems to have ended, and it's notable that AT&T, and by the way, I completely agree with AT&T's, I don't agree with everything necessarily in the petition, but I agree with the principle, which actually we first enunciated in the plan. We need to have a transition to all IP in which on a date certain the government says we will stop forcing you to invest in old networks. I completely agree with AT&T in that. But I would note that their investment, which is great, and I don't – Randall Stephenson determines this capital allocation, not people in Washington, I hope. But it's not going to get us world-leading communities. It's going to improve the competitive situation for tens of millions of Americans. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying what Kevin is dealing with and what Gig.U is dealing with and what, to some extent, Air.U is dealing with is this notion of the end that kind of pushes the envelope, hopefully builds up demand, and then changes the economics for AT&T and the cable industry so that we're not just good in the world, but we're actually leading the world.
The reason I wanted to talk about our investment is to point out that we are taking a different approach than other companies have taken. We're embracing our customers. We're saying we're going to be serving and providing innovative services to customers who are in the more rural areas, so that we're going to be covering in our 22-state wireline area, we're going to be covering, as I said, with our wireline and or 4G LTE, 99% of customer locations. That's significant. And that means that people who haven't had access are going to have it because of this investment. And we're going to do everything we can to reach as many customer locations as we can. We're going to continue to look for solutions. I mean, we've made that commitment. That's not to say that where there's, you know, for the most part, you know, consumers, we're meeting their demand. We're the services that we're providing, we offer various packages, various services. And where there's a demand shown, where there's a need shown for higher speeds, we're working with, if it's in the education community or other places, to meet those demands too. But when we're talking about the average consumer, it's not for that 1 gig capacity.
Yeah, I guess going back to your original question, Jessica, you know, what can you do to change the economics? I mean, there are two basic ways to focus on that, right? One is to try and lower your costs. The other is trying to increase your revenues. And there may be different strategies that we employ with rural America than we do in suburban or more urban environments.
Well, let me just clarify that even in urban and suburban communities, the costs are sometimes
sure,
a challenge.
Absolutely.
Density may not be the same issue, but the costs of deployment as well as the average cost that the customer can absorb sometimes mm-hmm. is just prohibitive.
Sure, sure. But, you know, in that I take Google Kansas City as an example. You know, we have, a decision that was made by a company to offer a product, not require it, but to offer a service that includes not only an internet offering but also a bundled video offering and the ability to perhaps attract more value from consumers by bundling additional services with the connection. We also see a decision not to offer a wireline voice product in light of a lot of attendant costs, I think, that are bound up with that. So one of the things that I think this, you know, this attempt, you know, to make a go of a 1 gig offering in Kansas City will help us determine is, you know, what are the levers, what are the areas in which we can offer greater incentives to provide greater value from the infrastructure provider standpoint, but also what are the ways in which we can minimize the cost of deployment, you know, whether you're talking about the cost that attend a voice product or the cost of attaching to a pole or regulatory drag or whatever those are.
Those are real costs. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask our panelists about the their perspectives on the FCC's recent announcement from Friday regarding the announcement to urge mayors across the United States to meet the challenge of seeking to deploy 100 megs in almost every city in America. And I'd be very curious to know what our panelists think of that and whether that's an achievable goal, what we can do as policymakers to make that a reality in both urban and rural cities and communities. So let's start with James.
Other way. I welcome the discussion. I think it's an important discussion to have. We're an aspirational nation. You know, we always, you know, our reach will always exceed our grasp in some standpoint. And it's important for us, I think, to have something to shoot at and to think about and to explore ways that we can collectively, both through private industry and government, you know, move the ball forward. If I have any issue at all is, and I'm not saying anyone on this panel, but I don't want our desire to find those new solutions that will make further advancements somehow reflect or allow people to argue that the advances that have come to date are in any way deficient or in any way insignificant, because I think they are substantial, they are broad, and they are not done yet. And so it's important to recognize that as we try to seek out these new experiments, these new test beds, you know, we're all for it. I mean, in some ways, you look at the cable industry. When we started developing DOCSIS technology, we did it through test beds. We tried it out over here. We saw consumers start to demand it, start to differentiate ourselves from our competitors, and we, you know, many years later have built these, you know, robust 50, 100 megabit and counting networks. So I think it's a good strategy to have. It can't be the only strategy to have, because there's incredible economic value in ensuring that everyone is hooked up to the net, and we just shouldn't lose sight of that fact as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I agree. I agree. I mean, you look as for AT&T when we're meeting our customer demand, and as I said before, where there are businesses and that have, you know, greater needs, AT&T and other service providers are being innovative, and they're offering different services, different pricing plans. And all of that has to continue. So I think all of these approaches are important, and you know, to get to the end result where we do have ubiquitous broadband and that we have all the benefits that broadband can bring to us.
Mm-hmm. So I was Friday. I was down in working with a bunch of different communities, going through some issues as we get moved toward an announcement, and my cell phone suddenly starts ringing off the hook, and bunches of text messages are coming, and I look at one, and it's the blog posting in Forbes about challenging mayors to do a gigabit in 50 states, and I was reminded of the Talmudic wisdom. If you are planting a garden and someone comes and says the Messiah has arrived, keep working on the garden. So I spent the day not responding to the emails or texts. I just was working on the garden. Look, I hope the FCC takes it seriously. I think there are lots of things the FCC could do. I would note, as to best practices, frankly, the Fiber to the Home Council has been doing that. We've been doing that, and there'll be some news on that in a little bit. But There's a lot of tools out there that I think are pretty good, so I'm not sure that's where I would put the focus. Workshops? Okay.
You'll show up.
I'll probably show up, or others could. I think, you know, Google could offer a lot. But there are a lot of different things the FCC could do. But I would urge them to look carefully at their own policies and see how they affect the equation that I talked about, because I'm not sure that they've already always affected it in a positive manner.
Thank you.
I think I'm in D.C., so I want to be very politically astute.
As opposed to me.
No need.
I would say the following. I think the FCC can certainly play a role. However, from Google's perspective, I think we'd prefer to focus on what we're doing today, tomorrow, next year. I think we have the unique – we're lucky in the sense that we have two founders who have very long-term time horizons, and they think about issues over a 5, 10, 15, 20-year type of time horizon. And when Google talks about moving the web forward, I think we're really not interested in incremental changes. We know there's an issue when we have product managers who have great product that, frankly, will never ship because consumers cannot consume it in their homes. And I think when that happens, not necessarily something will change next year or the year after that, but it really urges us to rethink the trajectory that we're on. And I think from that standpoint, we think step function changes are critical. We really think it is about 100 times improvements. We think that's really when you drive innovation. The change from dial-up to broadband, and credit to a lot of the folks represented here at the table today, all the things that we do on the web today were not things you ever would have imagined doing on dial-up. Shopping, maps, watching videos online. I can go on and on about the way it's changed our lives, business, enterprise use cases that are out there. Notwithstanding all the storage technologies, the networking technologies that grew up to build, to support these growing industries, I think these are the types of things that happen when you fundamentally get a critical mass of users that are connected with ultra-high-speed connections. And that's really what Google's been very focused on. I would point back to, rather than look at this from a DC perspective, I think I'd look into the field, what users are doing, what local communities who've been amazing in showing leadership are doing and can do. And I think we've been trying to be very prescriptive about, at least from our humble perspective, the five things that we think communities could do to encourage new entrants into their markets. And I think, again, when there's competition and when users have choice, I think that tends to lead to pretty good outcomes.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, I think that if one wants to look at, you have a Kansas City model, you have a Seattle model, you have a Chicago model now, you have a New York model, there'll soon be another model. These are things that are extremely valuable, and I think every mayor ought to be looking at. There are different ways of doing it, and different cities have different strengths. But any mayor should have a bandwidth strategy.
Can I chime in on one additional thought?
Please.
Okay. I just wanted to add, one thing that's really amazed us is not just the innovation, the Silicon Prairie storylines that we've seen, and literally startup villages that have huddled and grown up around areas where we've made our initial deployments. I think that's been interesting and really outstanding. But one thing that's really shocked us is that in Kansas City, over the next 2 years, every new apartment building that's coming online will have fiber built into it. Every builder has approached us, asked us for our specs, and people are building fiber into their homes. When we looked at the real estate market, on the form, fiber connected is now part of the real estate forms in the local market, and we see houses that are being advertised for sale. We're seeing people advertise the fact that they have a fiber drop. And I think these are just astounding changes, and I think This is middle America. These are what we at Google would argue not our early stage adopters, if you will. This is the mass market, and I think we're astounded by what a little bit of education and a lot of people, talking about these issues can drive.
I would just note that college students rate bandwidth as like the number one criteria for where they choose an apartment.
So you give up food over
right, which is another.
I would say community colleges as well. And even any area where there's some level of, you know, community activity, whether it's a community health center, a rec center, even where the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts, you know, meet and take STEM classes. I mean, there's lots of applications. Do you want to add anything?
No, I mean, I think those are all communities where it's also ripe for us to look at the demand side of the equation. Mm-hmm. I mean, the mm-hmm. fact of the matter is we have existing networks that can provide, you know, all the bandwidth you want to consume. The question is, can we create the business model and mm-hmm. the operational model? And, you know, we're all going to be parsing, you know, the success or failures of what happens in Kansas City and elsewhere, but mm-hmm. we're all trying to search for the models that will allow us to meet the demand we get from consumers.
Right, so financial feasibility is a big issue. Sure. Completely agree. We're going to go over a couple of minutes because folks came in a little bit later from the lunch, and I want to make sure I'd like to open this up to everyone in the audience. I know we have a lot of really smart people in the room. If you could just come to the mic and just tell us who you are and ask questions.
Hi, I'm Mustafa Naseem. I'm a graduate student in Colorado, currently interning in Verizon. My question is with Kevin, and you mentioned that you have founders that have a really long vision, long-term vision, and I'm just wondering in terms of the applications that can come out. I can see the use for a gig with entrepreneurs or commercial users, but for home users looking into the future, as in even with 8K, that doesn't really justify a gig, or I can see users uploading their content onto the cloud and then using streaming down their content, and that shouldn't take more than 200 or 300 M. And so I'm wondering if you can mention some of the uses for a gig at home.
Yeah, I think the cool thing about it is we actually don't know. What we do know are we have a – so 100% of the use cases that are out there 5 years out, we have no idea. But what we do know is that there are early footholds. And let me give you three quick examples. Number one, when you have a critical mass of users, as Blair alluded to earlier, that are connected with high-speed connectivity, a lot of things start to change. We've gotten probably 6 or 7 phone calls from CEOs of large companies that are waiting to deploy new types of applications and use cases in Kansas City when enough users are up and running. We think that's one way you try to figure out those applications. Number two, we know that video conferencing, you know, with a little bit of fidelity and the instantaneousness that comes with a real high bandwidth video conferencing, you change the entire user experience. So a tool that previously didn't work very well for replicating an in-person interaction now actually really does. And for those who've used it, it's an outstanding experience, not for all medical applications, but certainly for the ones that we've been seeing in Kansas City, in-home patient monitoring, post-surgical. Right, we've seen nutritional dietitian consultations, etc. Right, but again, you have to get the chicken. You know, you have the chicken and the egg problem in all of these mm-hmm. cases. You have to have enough of the infrastructure and then be able to drive ecosystems around that. Because I'll give you the example on telemedicine. Hospitals need to staff very, very differently to deal with somebody who's sitting at home that wants to quote unquote dial in. It's a very different staffing model. And so these are the kinds of things that you see. And then finally, I'll just say, we believe fundamentally in. People will drive innovation if you gave them the tools, and that's really what we're seeing in droves. There's a startup literally in one of the houses. They bought a house, and we're at one of our first fiberhood areas. I mean, they're building video conferencing applications with green screens behind them where multiple people can kind of present together on screen. It's just a fascinating kind of use case. And there are, for every one of these, there are 10, 15, 20 of these examples that are floating around.
So can I just add real quickly? We talk about a gig named the gig.u. It's really not about that. It's just really about the upgrade to the next generation. I think this is true. It wouldn't have made any sense for Google to build a network to offer 200. The difference between the cost at 200 and the cost at a gig is there's no difference. So this is about that next generation, that, you know, accelerating the next upgrade, and you might as well future-proof it because both the CapEx and the OpEx are basically the same.
I would also chime in. I think relative to where the market is today, and by the way, there are plenty of people that are doing 50, you know, 100 megabit services. I think that is on the horizon. So for us, it was about the step function change. I'd say that the uplink we're finding is really, really important to people. That is one of the big weight limiting factors when you think about cloud computing, the ability to get content. Like try uploading your kid's soccer game. If you video it in high def, it's like a multi-hour exercise.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? I know we have a lot of really smart people in the room that might want to ask something that are very interested in this entire topic from beginning to end. There we go. Okay.
Shock. Don Means, Digital Village, and the Schools, Health, and Libraries Broadband Coalition. Why not take at least an intermediate step for deployment of gigabit to all 150,000 anchor institutions to boost the general network build out and to supply gig level services to over half the population access the internet through those institutions? So why not that as an intermediate step? I think it was Microsoft suggested that we could do that for about $7 billion. Wouldn't that be the biggest bang for the buck among these different kinds of approaches? Anybody?
Wait, Don, don't go away. Didn't we kind of do that with the UCAN?
We kind of did it. We talked about doing it, but we didn't fund it.
Well, we funded 300 and how much did we fund? 300 and something million.
I think we got to about 10% additional anchor institution.
The BTOP.
The critical infrastructure.
10 to 15%, I think, is what we accomplished through BTOP.
Yeah. Right.
Well, look, first of all, I would just note, okay, yeah, I mean, it's not nothing. The UCAN project, for folks who don't know, is precisely an anchor network kind of network. I'm a liberal Democrat. I would be delighted if there was a new stimulus package, and I'd be delighted to sign on with you for that. I don't think that's going to happen. And one of the things one of the working assumptions of gig.u, and by the way, I'm extremely grateful for how Google did it in Kansas City, because they did not ask for tax dollars. They did not ask for tax referrals. But rather, they did a very smart thing that we agree with, was they tried to figure out what is it that the community can do to lower the CapEx, OpEx risk, improve revenues and system benefits and competition to drive it from the private sector model. So look, if we're talking about government money, that's a different discussion, but at least from the gig.u perspective, and Seattle did the same thing, and for the most part, all of our communities are looking at it the same way. It's really not about the utilization of public dollars, but if for some reason that comes back on the table, then we should have that discussion.
Well, actually, in Kansas City, doing the reverse, right, Kevin, where supplying that connectivity to those anchor institutions is part of the market support and build-out.
Yeah. It was so just for context purposes, as we build out in Kansas City across the various fiberhoods, we are connecting on the order of 400 anchor institutions with free gigabit connectivity. These are schools, community centers, libraries, all the way through. Our perspective is, it's kind of the opposite in many ways. It is privately funded. We're doing that for two reasons. One, we think that having a shared value is important for people in their communities to see that their community organizations get connected. And two, just a little bit more selfishly, if you want to drive innovation, right, you need critical masses of users at home and at their anchor institutions, right, to be connected with the same type of connectivity. And we think that's just a critical imperative to lay a foundation for real application and service sort of development. And so those are the reasons for it. And I think the anchor institutions play just such a critical role. I would default back into one other thing. I know there was a comment earlier about the digitally divided. And I think that's an important part of this, that in Kansas City, 28% of the citizens in the areas that we're building do not have broadband at home. And in a lot of the neighborhoods where we found more than half the population didn't have broadband at home, it's an education process. And I really, this was the lesson that we'd seen the data, we'd intellectualized it from the National Broadband Plan, but when you go in the field, it's a 25-minute engagement with one of these people face-to-face. That's what our field teams are doing. It's a long process. And I would say that you have to have hardware, access, and digital literacy, .. literacy in many cases, but these solutions come together really in the libraries, community centers that are out there in the neighborhoods.
And businesses,
but yeah, exactly. But these anchor institutions play a vital role in that.
We saw that in first generation broadband where a lot of people had their exposure, a feeling of it, not just a diagram showing straws and fire hoses, but thank you.
Thank
Thank you so
but
much.
But also, you know, I mean, I think it's an important point for the people who are not yet adopters, too. I mean, I'm not, I hope they do become gigabit users in the future, too. But, you know, when you're talking about basic digital literacy skills, you're not talking about big bandwidth needs. You're talking about trying to create a culture of familiarity, a culture of trust, you know, a comfort level so people can, you know, do a resume, apply for a job, mm-hmm. you know, check job listings. Those are not high bandwidth needs, but that is a real social problem that we still need to address.
This is interesting. This seems to be a supply-side, demand-side mm-hmm. Discussion here. Mm-hmm. But if an anchor institution can't utilize a gigabit, how can you expect a home user to utilize a gigabit? And so why not prove it there?
Or just get that level of high capacity throughput to these areas yeah. to start with.
Especially in rural areas, right?
Yeah, or I mean, just to, again, facilitate the kind of applications everyone here has been talking about.
As testbed.
Correct.
Demand driver. Supply side.
And I also wanted to point out, it's also a price point issue also. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, $70 for some mm-hmm. is going to be seen as a great bargain. There are going to be many households that can't afford the $70, and so they will look for something that will meet their needs at a lower price point.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, this was a really terrific discussion, and I there's so many other items that I wanted to delve into related to the types of challenges that we've heard about that communities could give us some input on, and even everybody at this table on what both state, local, and federal policymakers should be thinking about to really clear through those barriers, even from a trenching standpoint, to get facilities out there. So please join me in thanking everybody on this panel.